Hey guys, and welcome to another episode of Ireland Crimes and Mysteries. I want to thank you for joining me today, and if you're a returning listener, I want to say a big thank you for your continued support. If this is your first time listening to my podcast, welcome. It's great to have you on board. So without further ado, let's get started on today's story.
Ireland Crimes and Mysteries is presented by Go Loud, Ireland's leading audio publisher and the home of Irish podcasts. Find new episodes on the podcast first on the Go Loud app and on your favourite podcast platform. Just a quick note before we start, we had a slight delay during the recording that caused a bit of an echo in places. We've cleaned up most of it, but you might notice it here and there. But doesn't take away from what it was a really fascinating conversation with Kenneth about Annie's case and his career in federal law enforcement. In March 1993, 26-year-old Annie McCarrick disappeared from her Sandymount apartment in Dublin. Over three decades later, her case remains unsolved, one of Ireland's most well-known missing persons cases. Today I'm speaking with Kenneth Strange, a former FBI agent who's been working on Annie's case for years. But his connection to the McCarrick family goes back much further than that. Annie's father was Kenneth's high school teacher. Her mother worked at the same school. And Kenneth's own sister played with Annie when they were children. Kenneth spent 21 years working terrorism, counterintelligence and public corruption cases across three federal agencies. He's also the author of A Cop's Son, One GI Man's Fight Against Jihad, Global Fraud and the Cartels, which covers his federal career and the cases he worked on. In this conversation, he talks about what he thinks went wrong in those early days of the investigation, the important evidence that was overlooked for years, and why the focus of Enniskerry might have led investigators down the wrong path. He also tells us of his 2021 trip to Ireland, when he retraced Annie's last known movements himself, and what a Garda officer said to him that changed everything. Before we get into Annie's case, Kenneth shares a bit about his own background, from teaching Spanish in Saudi Arabia to the Saudi royal family, to eventually joining the FBI. This is a conversation about a case that's still very much alive, and a family that's been waiting for answers for 33 years now. Welcome, Kenneth, to Ireland Crimes and Mysteries. I'm absolutely delighted to have you on the podcast.
Same here. Thank you so much, Niels, for having me on. It's a real pleasure.
Oh my God, I'm delighted. It's a pleasure for me too, and I'm sure it'll be a pleasure for all my listeners to hear what you have to say. So before we actually talk about Annie now, I'd like to start with you, obviously. Can you tell me about your background and what first led you into a career in the FBI?
Yeah, sure. So I'm from Brooklyn, New York. I'm the oldest of five kids. My father was a police officer with the NYPD. My mother was a secretary, or I guess today they would call them administrative assistant. And when she started having children, she just stayed a homemaker, a mom. My life was basically urban, middle class, lower middle class upbringing. With lots of friends. My mother was of Irish descent.
So you've got a bit completely. Of Irish in you.
Yes, I do. I guess it's 50%.
that's a good
thing. Yeah, and the people, and I've been to Ireland and visited the relatives in County Sligo, although we had people from Dublin and County Roscommon. So, that were, again, growing up Catholic and middle class, and my father, of course, was a tremendous influence on all of us. And as a police officer, I looked up to him, and I would say he was probably the greatest influence on my life.
Oh, isn't that a lovely thing to be able to say about your dad? So it is.
So I would start by saying that it was the key was my father's influence, because that was always in the back of my mind. I was very proud of the police, and the police officers I met, I liked, and they were kind of my heroes. And I thought, in the back of my mind, I might be interested in in following a career in law enforcement. But at the same time, and this is due to my father, believe it or not, but he, when he was a police officer, he started to study Spanish. And this is when I was like 10 or 11 years old. And I found him one morning down the basement. I think it was a Saturday morning. He was off from work and he was listening to Spanish records and repeating words. And I said, "Dad, what are you doing?" And he said, "Son, join me." And I did. And I listened to the records. I practiced with him. And the next thing you know, I fell in love with Spanish language. You know, I took it in high school. It became my major in college. I lived in, studied in Madrid, Spain. And then I became a Spanish teacher after I graduated from college. And that would lead me to an English teaching job at the same high school, which then led me to a position in Saudi Arabia, teaching English to the Saudi Arabian royal family.
My
and
God.
After 5 years of that, I had learned so much about the culture, the language, the religion, and terrorism that when I finished my contract, I came back to the United States, went to a got an MBA, and was recruited by the FBI at that school, at the graduate school.
Wow, that's very interesting. That's a very interesting life to have.
It's convoluted.
No, but it's that's what makes it interesting.
Yeah, the doors just kept opening, and I kept going through them, and saying, "Why not? Right? Why not?"
You only get one shot
exactly.
at it, so you may. But
exactly. yep.
you know, that's mad. Like you know, so during your time then at the bureau, what kind of cases did you make?
So
mainly,
Nils, great question. I landed on a terrorism task force because of my background. And so I worked on mostly Middle East terrorism cases, a few foreign counterintelligence cases, you know, like spies. And then then they used me for my Spanish on a public corruption case in Newark. And I remember sitting on a wire listening to Colombian drug traffickers and money launderers. So
oh
I did
God.
That. So I was with the Bureau for 3 years and then went on to two other federal agencies during my 21-year career.
Wow. My God. No wonder you wrote a book, Kenneth.
I had to, just to get my thoughts together.
Yeah, it sounds so interesting. Oh, my God. I'll have to get my hands on it now and definitely read
yeah,
it.
Definitely. Oh, you'll love it. I think you'll love it.
That little snippet alone has me hooked. So it does.
Wonderful.
But getting to something closer to home for me, I suppose, you could say, and that you were very much involved in was the Annie McCarrick
case. Yes, that's right. It's a heartbreaking, as you know, it's a heartbreaking case.
Absolutely, absolutely. Before we get into how you were involved and all that, can you tell me a little bit about Annie, like the actual person behind the headlines? Because all we see of Annie is her picture, maybe documentary. You know
yeah,
what I mean?
For sure.
This
yeah, yeah.
actual real person.
And I,
who
you
was
know,
Annie.
Last night I was in preparing for this. I found some photos of John McCarrick, the father, Nancy McCarrick. Had a picture of my baby sister with Annie together as little children. So I knew her only as a child, pretty much. My larger relationship was with John McCarrick, because John was my high school teacher. And of course, his wife, Nancy, Annie's mother, was an administrative assistant in the high school. So I knew the family pretty well. And Annie's uncle, John Covell, was my high school classmate.
Wow. So you had a lot of different kind of avenues of where you came
with
to
the family.
But yeah, with the family.
Exactly.
Exactly. My God. And Annie then as a small little child, you know, you Have you vivid memories of her?
Here comes the horse girl. She'd come through the door. Parents would drop her off. And she'd have these little ponies and toy ponies. And, of course, my sister was with her ponies. And I said, just get out of here. Leave me alone. No, I don't.
Yeah. With Big Brother, you didn't
I don't want to trip over your toys. But, I mean, they were kids. They were beautiful kids.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, my God. And as I said, you knew that you had that personal connection then long before Annie's disappearance.
Yes. Absolutely. Yeah. And,
What do you remember? I think there's a bit, just for the audience, I think there's a bit of a delay here. So that's probably why we're talking over each other a bit. What do you remember most vividly about those early days after Annie's disappearance?
Well, to be honest with you, not too much.
Right,
because at the time, we're talking 1993, I'm right in the middle of a federal career. And I'm moving not only around the country, but I was overseas. Any word about the disappearance? I most likely came from my mother, who was very much in tune with what was happening back in Bayport, Blue Point, Long Island.
Yes. But you start to become involved more in
everything. I would say about 10 years later, I was now in Los Angeles working with the federal government, and I noticed that the case was still open. And I thought to myself, maybe I can help in some way, shape, or form. And so what I did is I reached out to the McCarrick, to Nancy, and I said, have you decided to report this to the FBI? And she said, no, I haven't done that. And I said, well, I would suggest that you do that so that there's something on paper in case the Irish police want to work with the FBI. Well, now everybody's on the same page. So she did that right away. And then, of course, I renewed my acquaintance with her uncle, John Covell. And so he was helpful. We kind of sifted through things together, worked on this case together, came up with some thoughts. I also reached out to the private eye that the McCarricks had contracted with, Brian McCarthy. And Brian was a fountain of knowledge. He knew a lot about the case. So it was very helpful. And and then I actually reached out some Guardi, current officers, although they couldn't speak to me a lot, and former, who were very helpful, and they were extremely moved by the case, and very sorry that it hadn't been solved.
Yeah, I can imagine I'm sure you can concur, if you're working on a case and it doesn't get solved and you end up retiring, it's probably, that probably plays in your mind more than all the cases you saw.
It eats away at you, especially cases like this.
Absolutely, absolutely. So from your perspective now, from your FBI perspective, when you were sifting through everything, what immediately kind of stood out to you about Annie's case?
Yeah, I mean, I was shocked at how quickly she had vanished and nobody knew anything. And, you always will look at the inner circle of friends first and spend a lot more time on these people. And that could be husbands, boyfriends, friends, coworkers, all of these people. But we'll concentrate first on that inner circle. I'm not sure how much time they spent on that before they were kind of exonerated and they moved on from that inner circle. But I thought that they should have spent time on that inner circle.
From the outside looking in, say, for me anyway, my perspective, it seems like they immediately kind of went down the road, the Enniskerry road, I suppose, say. And it was tunnel vision kind of.
Yes. Absolutely. But, you know, getting back to the beginning, I believe so much time had passed before. Not only was it called in to the parents, and the McCarricks then came to Ireland, and by the time the Gardaí got going with this, several days had passed. And you know, and I know. And I'm not talking about the first 48 hours.
No, I knew
it's almost a cliche. Every second counts. Every second. And it looked, when you go back and you look at it, it's almost like this thing was planned. Like whoever was responsible for the disappearance, murder, had time, knew things. You know, look at it. She was alone on that Friday. Her roommates had gone home. So she's alone. And these people would have known that she was contemplating a trip to Enniskerry. And then it's phoned in by one of the people in that inner circle to the family. Like the next day, that night, you know, we don't see your daughter. The apartment is dark. Is she okay? So a lot of time had passed. If you wanted to do something sinister, you certainly had the time to do it.
But yeah, you could take your time and cover your tracks kind of.
And come up with a story.
Oh God, that just gives me chills now to hear that. Like, you know,
right? Yes, and then as you said, Knowles, the once they had gone past all the airtight alibis of that inner circle, I must admit, I hitched my wagon to somebody else, and I went along with the Enniskerry visit, and that opens the door to a possible, to a convicted rapist, possible person out there that might have done if he had come across. But again, the likelihood of a stranger killing you is very, very slim. It's usually people that you know.
So is that the part that really troubles you to this day, is the fact that too much time was given to Enniskerry? You could say nearly 30 years. Like, it's only in the last few years we've heard that they've kind of brought it back to Sandymount.
Exactly.
That area.
Exactly.
That's a lot of years.
Yeah, like, and we've talked about this, Nils, that time is the investigator's greatest enemy for so many reasons. You know, memories fade, witnesses die, maybe even the people that are responsible for this are gone. So bodies decompose.
And justice then is never done, and there's no chance of getting any back.
And you think about it, the McCarricks are kind of this and are frozen in grief, and it never gets better. It's like constantly up and down, up and down, hope, despair. That's the way it is.
There's only so much a human can take, like, of that. Like I said that before, even you're saying they're frozen in grief. All these girls that are missing, say, from Ireland back in the 1990s, that vanishing triangle,
as they call it.
Every picture you look at them, like, they're all frozen in time as well, you know.
It's hard to believe.
Yeah. Like, you look at these grainy photographs from the 90s. And
there's someone's daughter, sister. Yeah. Cousin. Yeah.
And a whole potential
life.
Life.
They'll never get there.
It's awful. It's awful. Like, you know, were there times over the years where you actually thought, genuinely believed, I suppose I'd say, that there would be a breakthrough, that there was a breakthrough coming or close? Did you ever feel like, I know you're saying it was up and downs and peaks and troughs, but was there ever a time when you went, I think this might be it?
Not really. I took a trip to Ireland in September 2021. because I wanted to retrace any steps. And I did it on my own dime. You know, okay. I mean, that's how strongly I felt about the case. And Mrs. McCarrick had a message she sent through me to the police as well. So, but it was only at that time when I actually retraced the steps, thought about this trip to Enniscary, started to have doubts about it because I realized it was a longer trip than I thought. It was like at least about an hour and a half. And by the time she was going to do this, it was afternoon, winter, not much light. It didn't make sense. Didn't make sense. So I posed that question to the officers who met me. And look, they were very reserved. They were not going to give up anything to me. But they did answer my question. And I said, you know, I just did this trip. I just retraced her steps. And I'm having doubts about this line of inquiry. And yes. One of the officers said to me, you wouldn't be wrong to think along those lines. And that's when it hit me. That was seismic for me. Because I realized at that point, Enniscary was out. And they were going back. They didn't tell me that. But I knew.
No.
Exactly. They were going back to the beginning. And the beginning meant that inner circle of friends. And I took heart from that. And I said, we have, okay, thank you. And I left. I didn't say anything. But I knew they were going along the right way.
Yes.
And they were serious. And they seemed persistent. And it was encouraging.
Yeah. But that's nearly 5 years ago now, isn't it?
Yes. Exactly.
And like you were saying that you got Annie's mother, or you said to Annie's mother about getting in touch with the FBI and putting it on record. Like, how crucial is international cooperation in cases like Annie's? Like, you know.
Huge. It's huge. I'll tell you two things. I was able to get John Douglas. You know, he's the author, former FBI criminal profiler, Criminal Minds was trying to remember the book that he did. But anyway, we were able to get in touch with him and he came over and he did a profile for the Irish police.
Right.
On the other person who, in the beginning, right? And he had an amazing profile. I mean, spot on. But there was a situation where there was cooperation and there was promise. Mm. Now, after that, I reached out to another person in the FBI. This was like a liaison officer for foreign police. And I got him in touch with the Guardie. But he offered, I talked to him and he said, I offered our assistance, whatever they need, they can count on us in the FBI. But he never heard back from them. And I thought, you know, if they had gotten a fresh set of eyes, let's say another criminal profiler as a consultant, just to kind of talk, you know, talk case investigation. Who knows?
Yeah, fresh ideas, a fresh perspective.
Exactly. But that didn't happen. That was disappointing to me.
I'd be annoyed, like, you know, all this has been handed to you, basically.
Sure.
And
whatever you need. You need ground radar? Do you need certain cameras that'll focus CCTV from years ago, even tighter? I mean, they've been known to use things from the CIA. Borrow from the CIA. So I thought anything is possible, but
it never happened.
Thank you, but no thank you. You know, we'll handle it. We'll take it from here. But I think even more concerning to me, and this was an earthquake. We were doing an RT documentary in Long Island And this again was just three, four years ago.
So I think I saw that documentary.
Right. And so while we were making this documentary, we found out that the Guardi, back in 1993, had received or had asked for, or Annie's close friend had submitted testimony to them. Either it was faxed or it went with John Covell, who handed it to the Guardi. And that testimony indicated, I think there were two or three friends, that Annie had kind of shared with them that she had been in a relationship with one of the people in this inner circle, and it was an assault by that person, allegedly on Annie, just days before she disappeared. Now, the Guardi said, no, we never received this. But then they went back and they looked and they found it. Like, oh my how many God. Years later? So imagine.
Oh my God.
Imagine this, Knowles. If they had received that back in 1994, they could have gone back to the inner circle. We wouldn't have been following the other guy all over the world. And who knows? The case solved. Maybe. So that was a mistake. No, it was a big mistake. You know.
That's a seismic mistake.
Oh, my God. It's almost unforgivable.
It really is.
You know, that's something where you get it. You know, that this is a priority to get it to the case file, get it to the case agents, and wrap it up. And because this is critical evidence.
Yeah, it's pertinent information. And you said from the inner circle, like, sure. You know, that we're probably in the know, like, you know.
Yeah, would have saved it.
Oh, my God.
A lot of time.
Oh, that's just heartbreaking to hear that now, right. Kenneth.
But, you know, again, as these things go, certainly, you know, I've taken some comfort knowing that the case is progressing, that they interviewed someone overseas, that information may have led to another person being detained. Then there's a search of a house. So I see the case evolving. It's like they're building a case. I hope that is what it is. But I don't have any information about what they're doing or where they are.
You just hope that they're still working away in the background, basically.
Yes, I hope that's the case.
We were all, I think it's over a year ago now, I think it was at least 2024 when that all happened. It was all over the news here, obviously.
That's right.
I mean, any case is one of the most...
Yeah, high profile.
...cases in the country still to this day. And, like, I can understand on a very minute scale the you're kind of this hope when you hear it, and then that devastation when you hear that the person has been released without charge.
Right. But, you know, this group of investigators that they have, I find them to be serious and persistent, and they want to get this
a different animal
thing done.
Yeah. Please God. Oh my God. Please God. What would you say to people, say, who may not realize, you know, that the passage of time doesn't lessen the importance of a missing person case or the impact on the family, like, if they know something after all these years and haven't.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's effective to frame this situation around the concept of ambiguous loss. And that's a state of trauma where there's no closure and no finality. So the passage of time only increases the suffering of those people who are involved. Essentially, they're frozen in grief. And they go through these cycles. And I've studied it now, for many years. They're going through this cycle of hope and despair. And at this point, they don't care what happened. And Mrs. McCarrick has told me, I don't care what happened. I don't want to know the details. I just want my daughter to come home.
I know. I've heard that so many times, Kenneth, from different families. After all the years, that seems to be a general consensus. You know, I was actually working on a script today, and that was exactly what was said from person's brother. We just want to be able to bury.
I understand that. I've been touched personally by Mrs. McCarrick, and I can still relive those moments outside church. Our Lady of the Snows, we're talking, and she says, please, I know I'm never going to see her again. Please bring her home.
Poor woman, only
Whoa.
Child.
It's still moving to this day. Hear those words.
None of us can step into her shoes and understand what she's feeling. So we
right.
can't.
And that case is not over until the person comes home.
What would be meaningful progress for you? Obviously, meaningful progress would be it being solved, but what would be meaningful progress to you that you'd say, okay, we're nearly there?
I mean, you got to find the remains.
Find
that's,
her remains.
That's going to be very difficult. She could be in the Wicklow Mountains, the Irish Sea, or buried inside somebody's concrete building. You just don't know. But I think what you have to do is investigators, I've got to go back to 1993 and take a very close look, put these people under the ice microscope. Where were they working? What were they doing? What projects were they working on? What cars did they have? Who were they dating? All of this. I hope they've done this. You know, can always revisit something. And with your show, other shows like this, someone's listening.
Yes,
and they're
absolutely.
Thinking, I know something. I've been sitting on it for many years, and I've got it. I've got to help out. You know, I've got to help Mrs. McCarrick out, or I've got to get this off my chest because it's killing me. It's eating me alive.
Yeah, pure. I mean, people's circumstances could have probably more than likely have changed in over 30 years. You know, your loyalties to people kind of changed.
But Nils, I believe there are people out there that know things.
Absolutely. 100%. It is only, I know it's a long time for the case, obviously, to be unsolved, but from the point of view of knowing stuff and all that, it's still not that long where you can't come forward and actually make a difference.
Right. And I would hope and pray the people that have that type of information will come forward. It's the right thing to do.
It's the right thing to do. And, you know, give poor Mrs. McCarrick some peace.
Amen. Amen. She's 81. So she's looking at just a few more years.
Yeah, she deserves it. She's had 30 years now. I mean, since her 50s, you know, she was a young woman, you could say, when this happened.
Yeah, and not only Mrs. McCarrick, but my classmate, John Covell, Annie's uncle, he passed away 2 years ago. And that's a serious hurt for me. You know, because we work this thing together back and forth. We got very close. And now he's gone.
And he's gone without the answers.
Exactly.
As I often say, if there is an afterlife and these people have gone, you know, you'd often hear people saying their mother passed away, their father passed away without knowing. And I always say, if there is an afterlife, hopefully they've met that person on the other side. Mm-hmm. And now they know. Now they know.
Yeah.
That's always my hope.
Yes. I know. I get it.
You know, but listen, I mean, all I can say, and I'm sure you reiterate, and we've said it already, is like, please, if you do know anything, please come forward and give that information, even anonymously, just come forward. Even if you're just ring or and say from a phone box.
And Nils, I would say this, you know, people can write to me. I have an email address. It's Kenneth Strange. One word, @AOL.com. I'm sure they can reach out to you.
Yeah, they can absolutely reach out to me. I'll put your email at the in the description.
Thank you. And there is one Guardi who I trust implicitly, and that's Detective Sergeant Jonathan Kelly from the Irish Town Guardi Station. He's a good man. He's serious. And he's persistent. So people can reach out to him as well.
Absolutely.
And anything anybody, if people do reach out, obviously everything that they say, you know, will be treated with no care.
Confidentiality.
Sure.
Glad you mentioned that.
Yeah. And if Annie's family were listening to this conversation today, what would you want them to hear from you? What would you want to say to Mrs. McCarrick?
So I would say, Mrs. McCarrick, Nancy, you don't realize how many people in Ireland feel your pain and love your daughter. And they really do. And I know that because I was over there and I talked to them. And it seemed like almost everybody knew about Annie McCarrick. And they were wishing me the best. And some of them gave me information, which I turned over to the police. Mm-hmm. But the one man, he was an elderly gentleman. I met him in Sandy Mount. And he said, I know the case so well. And he got choked up. And he didn't know what to say. And he said, finally, he said, please tell Mrs. McCarrick, we love her and we're thinking about her all the time. And then impulsively, he reached into his pocket, he grabbed some coins and some bills. There were some bills in the pocket too. He puts them in my hand and he said, this is the least I can do to help you, to get a cab, to get around here and ask questions. He says, I want to help. I mean, this is what I found all over Ireland. From Carlo to Enniskerry to Sandymount, everybody.
People want this solved, you know. We want all the cases solved, obviously, but like Annie's is one of the earliest, I suppose, for my generation anyway. And we want it solved, you know. I know every Irish person I've ever talked to about the case are totally invested in wanting peace of mind for Annie's mother and for her to get Annie back in whatever way that is. Obviously, we're talking 30 years now, so we're probably talking about her remains back.
I would think so. But, you know, you bring up a good point. The other women that have come missing, and I've got to know them through this case. You know, Deirdre Jacobs, Dempsey Girl, Pender, Jojo, all of them.
Yeah.
And we're all in the same boat. We're frozen in time.
Yeah. There's a lot of them, unfortunately, for such a small little island. And, you know, I said it to you before when I was talking to you, it kind of hits hard when it's a visitor to our country who came to our country with all these, I suppose, aspirations. And, you know, she was a young girl at the time and she was looking forward to the adventure.
Right.
We're on our soil, like, you know.
No, she loved Ireland, that's for sure.
You know, it's not what we want. It's not what we want. As a kind of how people perceive our country.
Well,
you know?
It happens in my country too, Nils. Some foreigners come visit our country and they're murdered. And then that just makes us feel terrible.
Of course, yeah. It's human nature, isn't it? So, yeah. So, I suppose to wrap up about Annie, if there is one thing you wish the public truly understood about Annie McCarrick's case and cases like Annie's, what would it be? What would that be now that you have the opportunity to talk to the public?
Yeah, I would say, for any women involved in relationships, number one, if someone strikes you, hits you, abuses you, and that can be verbal abuse too, tell someone, share it with someone. Let them know you're not alone and get out of the relationship if you can. Definitely. Yeah.
Yeah, that's sound advice, Kenneth. Now, before we go, you were talking about your background and your life at the start of the podcast, and I mentioned that you did have a book. It does sound like, I mean, I'll hold my hand up. I've only been talking to you. I only talked to you for the first time last week, so I haven't had a chance to read your book yet, but from what I've read and what I've heard, And what you've said today, it sounds like it will be a really interesting read. So yeah. Could you give us, without giving obviously all the details away.
Yeah, sure. So the name of the book is A Cop's Son, One G-Man's Fight Against Jihad, Global Fraud, and the Cartels. It's an award-winning book. It's on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and Post Hill Press. And essentially, it goes back through my federal career with three distinct and distinguished federal agencies. And there are cases in that book that you'll find no other place in the world. And there's comedy, and there's sadness, and just about everything in this book. I just let it all out.
You cover all the
emotions. All the emotions. But always, as my father taught me, have a reverence for humanity. And again, this is my labor of love for my father. You know, he's the cop. He had a 40-year career. He saw everything from the first papal visit, the Harlem riots, Serpico, French Connection, Son of Sam. He lived through everything. And he was a motorcycle cop as well. Very interesting man. My father was a very interesting man.
He sounds it.
Yeah, he was kind of
There would have been a book in him as well, by the sound.
My friend says, you know, Ken, I love your book, but your father's story would have been even better.
Yeah, that could be volume 2.
But here's a funny thing, how my father's story began. So growing up, he was singing and acting, and he was in all the high school plays. And then he would go out in the neighborhood in Brooklyn with barbershop quartets and sing. So when he joined the police department, he's in the academy. He fills out a questionnaire. What are your strengths? And he writes down singing. So when they call, I guess one of the cops, upper management, he's got all these cadets there, and he's assigning them, you know, you and Muldoon, car 54, Chauncey, you have 34th and 6th. You're on that block. Strange glee club. They had a glee club.
And we all, of course, know the glee club now from the program over here. We know what the glee club is.
That's unbelievable. So it's kind of funny. That's where he started. And of course, the other is cadet friends. They were not happy about that. They're freezing. They're freezing on the street corner, driving around. And my father's singing from.
And he's in there entertaining.
He's an entertainer. Amazing.
He sounds like a character, so he knows you're dead.
But the NYPD closed the glee club down 6 months after he began singing. They needed more police on the beat. That makes sense.
It don't make sense, to be fair. Yeah. So he probably went around singing on the job, as they say.
Yeah, he certainly was. He would sing for his supper.
Yes, literally sing for his supper. Yeah, absolutely. Well, the book now sounds very interesting, and I can't wait to read it, Kenneth. And as you've said, you can get it on Amazon and all those places. Right. So if any of my listeners are interested, that's where you can get
Thank
it.
Thank you.
And Kenneth, it was an absolute pleasure.
Same here.
To have you on.
Niels, I really appreciate you having me on. And you've got a wonderful background reputation. So I'm honored. I'm honored to be here with you today.
Thanks very much, Kenneth. Hopefully if we can help Annie's case in any way, that's the end goal, as they say.
Exactly. So we just want to keep it alive, keep her aim alive, and the other girls as well.
Absolutely. That's my aim, is to keep them all their names out there. So yeah, so that they're not forgotten.
Exactly.
Yeah. So thanks, Kenneth.
Thanks for having me.
All right. No bother. We see you again. Please God.
All right. Cheers.
That was Kenneth Strange, former FBI agent and friend of the McCarrick family, sharing his insights into Annie's case and the investigation over the past 3 decades. If you have any information about Annie McCarrick's disappearance, please come forward. You can contact Detective Sergeant Jonathan Kelly at Irishtown Garda Station or reach out to Kenneth directly at kennethstrange@aol.com. All information will be treated confidentially. Annie's mother, Nancy McCarrick, is now 81 years old. She's been waiting for answers since 1993. If you know something, anything, now is the time to do the right thing. Kenneth's book, A Cop's Son, One GI Man's Fight Against Jihad, Global Fraud and the Cartels, is available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble and other major book retailers if you'd like to learn more about his career in federal law enforcement. Thank you for listening to Ireland Crimes and Mysteries. If this episode resonated with you, please share it. You never know who might be listening. Someone out there could have the information that brings Annie home. I'm Niels Nicklerig, and I'll see you in the next episode.
So guys, that's it for today's episode of the Ireland Crimes and Mysteries podcast. Again, thanks for your listenership, and don't forget to subscribe to the show and hit that auto-download so you never miss an episode. Until the next time, keep your eyes open and your mind curious. This podcast has been compiled from information gathered in the public sphere, like news articles, documentaries, and open source material that can be found on the web. Everything in this podcast is alleged unless a conviction has taken place.